Thank you, guys. Give it up for the band. Give it up for Kylie. Great job. So as we continue through our sermon series about impact, today we're going to talk about the times when it seems impossible to impact others because of all that we have going on in our own lives. Maybe you've been impacted by someone else's decisions and you're buried so deep in the fallout from that that it seems near impossible to reach out to others. My hands are full, Lord. I don't have an empty hand to reach out to others. You know, when the hurricane hit, like, my kids were all sick. We had no power, just like everyone else. Like, everyone had it bad, you know, tree down, roof leaking. And you're supposed to, as Christians, think about others, you know. And that's just a simple example. Those like, seem like big problems, but some of us have problems internally that are much bigger, that last much longer. And then we're trying to have this mindset of, like, I need to help others. I need to give others peace when I don't have peace. I need to give others joy when I don't have joy. How do we do that? Today we're going to look at a figure in the Bible who is in this exact predicament himself. And we're going to read a passage from Acts 27 about Paul. But first, because I'm going to read a lot anyway, I'm going to sum up where we are so I don't have to read two whole chapters. So at this point in Paul's life, he's been in prison for over 2 years as he waits for the Romans to decide what to do with him. Because the chief priests and the Jewish leaders want him dead, and so Festus, the Roman leader, the Roman in charge, keeps him imprisoned as a favor to them. He's got no reason other than he doesn't really want to anger them. He knows how volatile the Jews can be regarding their religious laws, so he keeps him in prison. He has no reason to charge him, nothing to charge him with. So finally, Paul, after 2 years, just appeals to Caesar, because every Roman citizen has that right. And he says, I'm done with this. I appeal to Caesar. And so Festus says, to Caesar you will go, which means he has to go all the way to Rome to stand trial before Caesar himself. So Paul and some other prisoners are handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. And on their way to Rome, they sail to several different ports before they end up in a place called Fair Havens in Crete. And here's a map of the journey. I just love maps. I hate when they're telling me stuff. I'm always just like, I don't even know where I'm at. I need a map. And the same way in the car. Daisy loves maps. I love navigation because I don't have to think, you know. And Daisy's like, just give me the map and I will figure it out. I will figure out where we're to go. And to me, it doesn't matter because either way, I'm just going to have a woman's voice saying, go left, go right, go left. Like, I've stopped even, like, remembering where things are. She'll be like, hey, drive me down to high school. I'm like, where is that? I don't even know what that is. Just tell me where to go, and I'll go there. So they are in this island, like, in the dead center right there, that little orange island. It's orange in real life. This is a real life picture. And that's where they are. Most of this journey so far, they just kind of hugged the coast, and it's been pretty safe. But here's where they have to go across the Mediterranean Sea. It's a long voyage with no land nearby, okay? So far, the wind's been against them for most of the journey, and so they've lost valuable time. And so here, they are faced with a decision to winter in Crete or to push on to Italy. And this is where we're going to begin our reading today when they're trying to make this decision. And it's Acts 27. Luis called me and he was like, hey, what's the verse? And I was like, Acts 27. He's like, what are the verses? And I was like, Acts 27. The whole thing. But I cut off 1-8 to help you out. So we're going to start in 9, and it's long. And I'll just do their voices to help things move along. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. So Paul warned them, men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. When the first time I read this, I said, how are they going to reach Phoenix? It's landlocked. And then Daisy showed me on her map that there's another one. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they saw their opportunity, so they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Kauta, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure, so the men hoisted it aboard. Then they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. That would give me great confidence. Because they were afraid they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'" On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea when about midnight, the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we'd be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. "For the last 14 days," he said, "you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head." After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of all of them. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. So much for that rope. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. And this way, everyone reached land safely. And that's it. That's my sermon. That's all I do at youth. It's really easy. You just read passage out of the Bible. So we see in the beginning, in the very beginning, Paul tells them, this trip will be disastrous. It will bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. But we see that it's Paul's word up against the pilot and the owner of the ship. And they want to press on. They let the desire for money eclipse their good sense. This ship is an Alexandrian ship, and it serviced Rome with expensive grain. If they don't deliver this grain in a timely manner, they don't get paid. So obviously, their vote is to press on. And just like we do today, when someone who is in authority or someone who seems to know what they're doing or should know what they're doing, like the pilot or the owner of the ship, make a decision, we usually just kind of like, oh, well, let's just hop on board. They know what's right to do. It must be okay, even though it goes against our good sense, right? We'll just do what they say. Now, this area they're about to cross is well known for its peril. Not just then, but like even today. For many centuries, this was called St. Paul's Bay, and even modern day yachts, many of considerable size, were wrecked here under similar conditions that they were sailing under. See, sailing here was doubtful in September. It was impossible in November. And guess when they leave? October. They leave in October, okay? So everyone on the ship knew it was not a good idea, but they do it. So this whole situation is caused by someone else's bad decision. 276 people on the ship are at the mercy of this storm because of someone else's bad decision. Have you ever suffered consequences because of someone else's bad decisions? Anyone? Maybe one or two of you? Maybe your parents, your spouse, your boss, your business partner, your kids. It can be so frustrating. It can make you feel so powerless, and it can become difficult to see your way through the storm because you're so angry, right? It almost helps in a way because you have that anger. You have someone to blame. It's their fault. It's not my fault. It's your fault. There's someone to blame. This is the situation Paul is in. He's been in prison for 2 years. He's on a ship headed to Rome only to be tried. And now, if I was him, I'd be like, and now I'm going to die on this ship because of those idiots. And that's why, because you're an idiot and you know you are. And every time I look at him, I look at him like, you are an idiot. Like, I don't know how his blood like wasn't boiling the entire time. Like, he does say like, listen, I told you this would happen, but take courage. He finishes with that. I might have been like, I told you. What did I say? Oh, who did you not listen? Oh, me. That must be so frustrating. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, that's my profession. Telling people to do things they're not going to do. And then helping them with their consequences. That's what I do daily. I'm like, oh, you're not going to listen to me. Oh, okay. Well, let's see how that turns out for you. And then I never talk to him again. Once you diss it, no, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, it helps to remember that you were a teen once too. Like, as I'm telling him, I'm like, you should do this, and you're not going to do it, but you should do that. But Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't just give up to him. He doesn't give up on him. He doesn't mope. In fact, he gives them hope when they're hopeless. He gives them hope when they're hopeless. He gives hope to the people who put him in this situation. And it's a bad situation. Things are dire, okay? They've passed ropes under the ship to hold it together. I'm sure that was like a well-known tactic then, but like that wouldn't give me confidence in anything. If you're flying in a plane and like you've got all this turbulence and they're like, we're going to be putting some ropes around the ship, everyone, don't worry, we got some ropes around the plane. It's going to hold together. You'd be like, oh my goodness. Whew. Worry gone. So they've lowered the anchor to be driven along. They throw all the cargo overboard, that precious grain that sealed their fate, the thing they risked life and limb for. This grain is the first thing to go. The cargo is the first thing to go, because all of a sudden, the most important thing becomes the least important thing when compared to their very lives. Next thing they throw over is the tackle. And if you don't know what tackle is, that's like all the man-made provisions to like steer a ship, like gears, ropes, pulleys, masts, planks, everything that man has made to master a storm and to steer the ship, to guide us on our way. Now they're in the hands of God. They're just in the hands of God being driven along. And this kind of happens with us too. Sometimes we're in a storm of our own making. Sometimes we're in a storm of someone else's making. But much like these sailors, once we're in the storm, we have to let go. First thing we have to let go of is that desire, that sin that led us here, that thing that was not worth letting go of. Often we get in that storm because we're just like, I'm not giving that up. I'm not giving that up. God, this is what I want. This is what I want. And it leads us into the storm. And then if we want to get out of the storm, we have to realize, like, wasn't really worth it, was it? Maybe you told me to not bring this for a reason. And then the second thing we have to do is to give up our control. We steered ourselves into the storm. We have to throw the tackle overboard, give up on our attempts to steer our own lives. And everyone on the ship is now in that place. It's in this moment when they are hopeless that Paul stands and gives them courage. He says, the ship will be lost, but not one of you will be lost. Last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, man. Nevertheless, you must run aground on some island. He stands up and gives them hope. Shortly after this, they start sensing that they're nearing land, and they start taking soundings. If you don't know what soundings are, here's a picture of Guy Hoagland taking soundings quite some time ago. But soundings were made. They'd throw a weighted, marked line into the water. It's simple but ingenious. And they'd pull it back up. When the lead hit the bottom, they could tell the depth of the water by the mark on the rope. And so they discovered they're getting closer to land. And so as they get closer to land, some sailors try to escape the ship by letting the lifeboat down and pretending like, oh, we're going to go down the lifeboat and drop some anchors from there. But Paul tells the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved. And on Paul's word, the soldiers cut away the lifeboat. On Paul's word, things have changed a little bit when he speaks, right? I mean, this is an important thing. It's in the name. It's a lifeboat. Like, you want to cut away the lifeboat? The thing that keeps us alive? Shortly after, the ship runs aground on a sandbar, and everyone has to abandon ship. The soldiers plan, okay, we're going to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away, because you know who's going to get in trouble for that? They are. If they show up in Rome and some prisoners are missing, guess who gets killed for that? They do, right? So they're just like, hey, let's save our own lives. We'll kill these prisoners. Then we don't have to watch them. We don't have to worry about them as we're like trying to save our own lives. Let's just kill them. But the centurion says no. And he saves all the prisoners' lives because he doesn't want them to kill Paul. Something's changed in the way they see Paul over this journey. And everyone reaches land safely, either swimming or hanging onto a plank or something. Everyone survived because they believed Paul now, because they obeyed Paul, because of however he was when the storm hit. During that trial, he proved something to them. So what do we do when the storms of life come? Sometimes our storms are really serious, but in the end, they end up being a lot like storms that come children's way. My son, Flynn, his Nina, his grandma, Daisy's mom, watches him on Monday and Tuesday when Daisy works. And he likes to like get costumes and go in dressed up as this person. Like, sometimes he dresses up as Darth Vader, which, like, you know, we have to then play the music like dun, 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 before he even starts. And then he comes around the corner and he's marching, here I am. You know, so recently he got this Batman costume and he wanted to come be Batman. Okay, which you know you love kids, so you make things happen. Because of the incredible pec muscles, he cannot wear this in his car seat, okay, because it's just too big. Meaning, I have to dress him outside real quick before he goes inside. And on this day, it's raining and the ground is wet. He has to take his shoes off. So I have to hover him and put all this stuff on. So I've put a lot into this, okay? Like, I'm invested. Like, so this. So when he walks in, every day she's in the kitchen. You know, and she's grandma. She's like, oh my goodness, Batman. And you can't be like, Flynn. You have to be like, Batman, where's Flynn? And he's like, I am Flynn. And so we walk in the door, and when you walk in the door, there's a laundry room, and then you go through a hall, and there's a kitchen. And she's not in the kitchen. She's standing in the laundry room. In the laundry room. The nerve. I was so mad at her. No, I'm just kidding. So the minute he opens the door and she's in the line, she's like, hey, and he's like, wah, and like throws himself on the ground. And he's just like, just saying unintelligible things. She's like, Flynn. And he's like, wah, wah, wah. And you're just like, seriously, dude? Like, but we act the same way, right? Like, we have, like, this is my plan. This is what's going to happen. It's going to be great, God. This is my plan. And then we start going that way, and then something happens. It doesn't look like we thought it would look like. And we're just like, ha! God! And we don't throw ourselves down, but, like, seriously, in our heads, we're kind of doing that, you know? And I'm like, really? Once he gets in there, whether it's in the laundry room or the kitchen, she's going to do the same thing. She's not like standing in the laundry room, and the minute he comes in, and because she's in the laundry room, she's like, you look so dumb. But something about the fumes in here, just, I'm irritated. You know? No, she's like, oh, you're so wonderful and amazing. And you're just like, okay, back off. No, I'm just kidding. Like, I can't live up to this at home. I have to tell him all that all the time. No, but it's the same reaction. It's the same thing happens, the same result. But when it doesn't look like we want it to, we don't get there the way we think we should, we just get upset with God. We do the same thing. But Paul doesn't. And because of it, there's this turnaround. There's a turnaround in how they see him. The prisoner that was ignored in the beginning In the beginning, before the storm, he doesn't matter. And why should he? I mean, he's a prisoner. If like some prisoner was like, we should not go. Like, you'd be like, shut up. Who is this guy? There's enough people talking. He's a nobody, right? But in the midst of the storm, he becomes their leader, man. They're cutting away the lifeboat on his order, the soldiers are. The centurion is saving all the prisoners' lives for him. The centurion is basically doing what Paul says, right? He must have earned some measure of respect on this journey. He must have earned their trust on this journey in this storm. But it didn't have to end that way. What if Paul had just sulked or abandoned them to their fate? What if he just wallowed in his own misery? Like, think about it. He's hungry, too. You think they're going to... I bet he had less food. You think they're going to give the prisoners just as much food when you don't know when you're going to eat again? You don't know if you're going to die? Right? He's hungry, too. He's wet, too. He was faced with the same hopelessness they were. In verse 20, Luke is actually chronicling what happens here. He says, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. He didn't say they did. He said, we did. We gave up all hope. Now, Paul could have blamed God or wondered where God was and be like, seriously, I'm in prison for 2 years and I'm over. And now, seriously, God, for real, it can't get any worse. Thank you. He didn't do that. He didn't. He could have fed off the anger. It wasn't his fault. He could have been like, that stupid pilot, that owner. Ah, you know, but he didn't do that. He didn't do it at all. He continued to give them hope. He continued to give them hope. And because of it, his life is saved, but 276 lives are saved because of Paul. Now, in our lives, storms will come your way. It's inevitable. No one lives like a storm-free life. Sometimes they're of our own making, and sometimes they're from other people's bad decisions. Sometimes they're consequences of someone else's bad decision. I'll invite the band up. But when these storms come, what do we do? Do we just want them to go away? Because that's what we pray for, right? We just pray for them to go away all the time. We want to avoid them altogether. We want to avoid them altogether. We shouldn't have any storms. Maybe we're like maybe I'm faithful in my prayers and desire for the storm to go away. I'm like on my knees every day. Praying, God, just take the storm away. Just remove the storm. I just don't want the storm at all. You know, there's a storm going right now in my life. I called the band up. They're not coming. I have to continue to talk, though I have nothing to say. I'm so glad it's not me. Yes. No, that's not really a storm, and I have more to say. I just really wanted to do that for fun. So... But like we do, we pray that the storm will just go away. That's like, oh God, I'm being hit by a storm. Just take it away. Just take it away. And we're like, God, the wind and the waves, obey your every word. Just make this storm stop. That's our prayer all the time. But maybe through the storm, God is going to save the lives of those around us. Maybe that's the intention. Sometimes we're like, Lord, just take this storm away, not knowing that through this storm, those people we've been praying for all of our lives are going to come to Christ because of how we are being in the midst of that storm, right? Like, our prayer should be, Lord, help me to shine a light through this storm. Help me to shine a light through the storm. We always say, like, Lord, help us to shine a light in the dark places. Like, we're going to shine a light in the dark of night. And then we get out there and we're like, but this is dark. I meant, like, dusk. Shine a light in the dusk. Maybe, is that what it says? What's your interpretation say? Like, you know, but it's like, it's dark. It's dark, right? But that should be our prayer. Lord, help me to shine a light. Help me to keep my eyes on you. Lord, I don't know why this storm is coming. I don't know why I'm here. And really, honestly, I'll tell you the truth. I just want it to be gone. I don't want to go through this. We can be honest with that. We can be honest about that. But then we got to say, but Lord, man, I know you can do something with this. I know if I'm going through this storm, I know I can do something. Lord, if I'm going to go through this storm, I want to be saved. I do. But save the lives of the 276 around me. Use me. Use me. Because God can and God will. We just have to put our trust in him. We just have to put our trust in him and say, Lord, man, you knew about this storm. You knew the storm was coming. You knew what was going to happen. Am I holding on to something that brought me here that I need to let go of? Do I need to let go of control in this issue? I give it to you. Just help me, Lord. Help me to give it to you, because I know that you're going to take this. And you might not make the storm go away, but I'll get through the storm. And when I do, I'm bringing these people with me. Lord, we thank you that you are so good. We thank you that you always have a plan. We thank you that you have plans to get us out of the messes that our plans make. You are so good to us, Lord. You are so faithful. And I just pray that we would discover your faithfulness in the midst of the storm. That we wouldn't sulk, that we wouldn't mope, and that we wouldn't just keep our prayers devoted to getting out of the storm, but that our prayers could be devoted to what your plan is. That we could trust you. And know that maybe your purpose with this plan is not just to get us out of it, but for me to bring out those around me, to bring them out of the storm too. Thank you that your plan is always bigger and greater than ours. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.